Greg Wissinger of the King's Herald joins me to discuss bench shenanigans and whiny stomping grounds, the national perception of Domantas Sabonis, and the hilariously dominant defense of Keon Ellis, the Sacramento Kings. All that and more coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. You're happy with 50%? You're on top and you don't have enough. You're happy because you're successful for now. But what is happiness? It's a moment before you need more happiness. John Gennaro, count me in!
One, two, three.
Today's first words belong to Don Draper from season 5, episode 12 of Mad Men, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, new pillows. You know that thing where when you're 41 years old, you wake up every morning and your neck's kind of jacked up and you're more sore than seems reasonable given like your level of activity? Turns out that sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, that's because you're sleeping on an old ass, flat ass, busted ass pillow that provides no nighttime support for your neck and head regions. And then sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, you get a new pillow. And then suddenly, you feel better, which is really all you can ask for if it's a 1% improvement on your sleep. And number three, more important than all of that, I get to spend part of my morning talking with someone whose coverage and overall presence on the internet makes me feel 2% better. My guest today is a wonderful writer and podcaster whose work has appeared on Sactown Royalty and in the Sacramento Bee. These days, he is the managing editor of the King's Herald, your one-stop shop for independent and obsessive coverage of the Sacramento Kings. Friends, a warm welcome for Greg Wissinger. Greg, thank you so much for making some time for us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Greg, I feel like you didn't meet my level there on the excitement, but you know what? We're going to get there. We're going to get to that.
Well, I was disappointed because you said I only make your life 2% better. So, you know, I'm still a little hurt. I was hoping for 3, but we'll come back, I'm sure.
I mean, it's going to depend almost entirely on how this episode goes, but I'm confident. I feel optimistic. We got to start from a place of optimism in these sorts of conversation. Greg, I've asked you here today because I've been doing a lot of writing and talking about Western Conference teams recently. I had an episode on the Timberwolves, one on the Pelicans. I wrote about the Mavs and the Thunder. There's always Warriors, Lakers, Clippers talk because of big markets and things. But one team I haven't talked very much about or written very much about is the Kings. And they're a team that kind of became a critical darling last season, had the big light the beam breakthrough, and has flown under the radar a little bit this year, kind of finding itself coming to grips with the realization that our man Don Draper had up top. Success is a reality, but its effects are temporary, and you've got to sort of find more of it. So I'm interested in how the Kings and their fans are handling that, and I could think of nobody that I'd rather speak about that with than you, so you could help me understand it. And we will get into that. But first, on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Greg Wissinger, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
So the biggest thing that is bringing me joy this week is shenanigans on the bench. And there's been a couple of recent examples tied to the Kings that I've really enjoyed. So first, during the Kings-Knicks game over the weekend, there was a moment where the refs were reviewing for a flagrant foul on Josh Hart. And the Jumbotron in the arena pans to Josh Hart sitting on the bench, and Jalen Brunson notices and starts pointing at Hart and telling the crowd to boo him. And, you know, even Kings, like, I mean, that was such a hard-fought game. Emotions were high. But even in that moment, like, Kings fans all, you know, in the arena were laughing. And, like, it was just a wonderful moment. It's like, as much as I was frustrated during that game, like, you can't help but love these Knicks, right? Like, those guys are fun. And then we had some more shenanigans in Kings Grizzlies last night. At one point, Desmond Bain poured his Gatorade on Jaren Jackson Jr. turned a timeout and the cameras happened to catch it. I don't know what the context was. I don't know why he did it. It was just like red Gatorade, just like poured it on his arm sleeve. And then also Marcus Smart got ejected from a game that he wasn't playing in. He got like double technicaled for being on the court and berating a ref during a stoppage in play. So, you know, bench shenanigans. It's the little things that sometimes you catch on, you know, League Pass, or sometimes the broadcast catches it, and it just brings me joy.
That's perfect. I mean, Marcus Smart getting teed up and ejected from a game in which he was not participating is that is chef's kiss.
Yeah.
It's like you'd be hard pressed to find a player that you'd expect that from more, but you'd also expect to sort of wear it with grace. Like, you know, Marcus Smart doesn't seem like he's going to be too overly pressed about that. It seemed like he understands. You're absolutely right that one of the sort of quieter joys of this Knicks season has been the fact that that Jalen Brunson and Josh Hart just kind of are constantly negging each other and busting each other's chops. Like, we started to see it at the second half of last season, and a full season of that has really been delightful. Like, Jalen Brunson ascending to stardom and Josh Hart continuing to be like, not that cool. You're not that good of a guy and you're not that cool. And then Jalen Brunson responding to it by being like, I actually am and people should not like you. It's wonderful. Delightful business. You mentioned the Grizzlies game, and I peeked behind the curtain where we were exchanging messages yesterday, and you said you would be happy to do this show unless the Grizzlies, they lost to the friggin' Grizzlies. And they nearly lost to the friggin' Grizzlies. So I'm wondering, like, yeah, they pulled out a win, the Kings, but I'm pretty sure I saw you and I saw, like, Akis, like, saying, I don't know that I want 5 more minutes of this game. How are you feeling after the survival of a Kings win in overtime over the moribund Grizzlies?
You know, at this point, it's become so commonplace for the Kings to underwhelm against, you know, I hate using the word inferior teams, but like teams with much worse records, you know, teams that they should beat. The Kings just all season long have really just not performed well. They don't execute. They, you know, have mental lapses. It's been one of the biggest frustrations of this season and one of the biggest differences from last season, where they were like really good in the clutch and, you know, just kind of a really reliable team that never felt like they were out of it. It feels like maybe they give up sometimes or just don't have it on certain nights. So, you know, right now I'm just happy they escaped with a win. You know, a win is a win. And at this point of the season with the West standings, every win matters. So I'm happy with a win. Like, I'm not one to, you know, get too upset about how you win a game, but it was frustrating throughout. I was, you know, kind of sitting there just, you know, especially in the fourth quarter, it's like, why is this game tied with a minute left? Like, what, we're really going to lose to the Grizzlies who have 8 people. And I don't know that they actually have 8 people. I think, you know, someone's on the active roster who is probably in street clothes. Like, I mean, the Grizzlies are so banged up, and, you know, it's credit to them, obviously. Like, you know, they come out, they still play hard and all that. But it is frustrating for Kings fans the way that the Kings just can't seem to get past that hump of, you know, actually just putting together a solid 48 minutes against a team with a worse record.
When you have to look up who a guy is on Basketball Reference to get mad that your team is losing to that guy, or that guy is putting up good numbers on you, that's a really tough place to be in. And so, yeah, there was a point several times during the game where it's like, I do this professionally. I do it at a national level, and I am not familiar with Jiro, number 77 on the Grizzlies. Haven't sampled his wares before. Let me find out what's going on here. You raise the point of like that differentiation from this year to last year. That's kind of where I wanted to start with this conversation. It was never going to feel exactly the way last season felt, right? Like, it took 16 years to break through. And then the way that the team broke through, this like collective populist movement where like you're shining laser beams into the sky and everyone is acknowledging that that's cool. And like all of a sudden it feels like this something special happening. And that like recapturing that or replicating that was always going to be probably never going to happen quite the same way. But I'm wondering, you know, the Kings enter Tuesday's action, as you said, you know, 6th seed in the West, you know, sole possession of that seed right now. They're earning their keep with the, you know, the likes of the Mavs and the Suns underneath them. And they swept the Lakers, and they're, you know, continually putting up good fights against good teams. But and they're a game off of last year's pace through 67 games. But how has this season felt? Like, you're trying to author this encore. You're watching a team trying to like find last year's formula, but having to iterate on it. What is the experience of watching like the year after the year been like?
It's been tough. And after the Kings mostly did nothing in the offseason, we kind of expected something similar to this. But even when you see it coming, it's still frustrating. So the expectation for most Kings fans going into the year was similar record, but a worse seed. You know, we were pretty realistic that like you know, 48 wins normally doesn't get you the three seed. Like last year was a very weird year. So there was that expectation that like, yeah, their wins are probably going to be in that same ballpark, but the West will be stronger. So they'll be further down, which is almost exactly how it's played out. You know, they're like I said, right on pace for right about where they finished last year within a win or two. And they're the sixth seed right now and kind of stressing about the play-in and all that. And it's just kind of a more normal standings as far as where that record puts you. But even seeing it coming, it's still been incredibly frustrating. It was just a lot more fun when, you know, the home stretch of the season was just, you know, enjoying and seeing how many wins you could get and not stressing too much about the seeding or the matchups or any of that just yet. Yeah, that being said, I try not to take it for granted. Like, it's still an incredible season because of everything we went through before. It's like, oh, we're complaining about only being the sixth seed after years and years of, you know, not even being close to the playoffs. So, you know, it's still, I mean, Kings fans, I think, are probably a little bit better equipped than most just because we did go through so many bad years that we can appreciate a good year that's not a great year. But it is frustrating because you want that team to continue to grow and continue to build on what they did before. Even though, you know, the front office didn't make any big moves, you know, either in the offseason or at the trade deadline. So it's like, you know, you're just kind of banking on internal growth that hasn't necessarily happened, which, you know, is frustrating, but there's still been plenty of good things and plenty of great wins along the way. And like you said, sweeping the Lakers makes every season better.
That's right. You know, if you weren't with me at my Rondo trade with the pick swap going out, then you don't deserve me at my Sabonis triple doubles. It's funny, you know, you mentioned that like general very sober view, and it's almost difficult when you're actually right about it, right? When you're like, yeah, I project it this way, and then it happens, and you're like, well, I was kind of hoping it would be different than that. But I was, you know, going through, I wrote about the Kings for today. It'll be up at, probably up by the time this comes out, at Yahoo Sports. And about that kind of like, you know, how do you author the encore to the critical darling season, that kind of thing. And there's a moment where I'm like, well, the Kings went from the number one offense in the NBA last year to the number 13 offense in the NBA right now. And I'm like, well, where are they falling off? And you start going through all the numbers and you're like, pretty much the same, pretty much the same, pretty much the same. And you're like, oh, they dropped five spots because like the Pelicans, Clippers, Thunder, and, you know, Pacers and a bunch of like these other teams all just like jumped up. Mm-hmm. It's not like the Kings got demonstrably worse. And there are some areas where, you know, like the free throw rate's down or they're not generating as much rim pressure. And there's stuff to analyze and poke at. But there is a component of it that's like, this is about who they are. The league just kind of the tide rose up a little bit and left them a bit more wobbly. And so that's why, like, you come to this place in the season where, and I will admit, I'm like not entirely sure what to make of them for the reasons we're talking about. You know, the record is good. They're outscoring teams by about a point a game this season, like not as good. 13th ranked offense, 20th on defense. Things have trended a little more positively recently for them, but not like great overwhelming numbers. I guess just like broad strokes, do you feel like the Kings are more like, or what's the overall relative quality of the team? Are they more, is it more like this is who the record says they are or who that kind of point differential says they are?
So the challenge has been that it's both. I mean, they are two different teams. It completely depends on the night. So the net rating kind of being middle of the road and not quite matching the record is just indicative of the inconsistency. So the fact that they're so up and down depending on their opponent is the biggest frustration and the biggest, like, who is this team? Why can't they figure it out? Why can't they bring it consistently? But the one thing we have seen is that they have consistently been playing well against better teams. Like, so many of their losses this year are against the Rockets. They've lost a game to the Pistons. They lost to the Hornets. Like, they've lost some really just awful, embarrassing games that they just, like, mentally weren't checked in for. But when the team is engaged in firing on all cylinders, they look fantastic still. You know, the one good team they really struggle with is the Pelicans. The Pelicans just have absolutely had their number and just destroy them with, you know, their length and physicality. And that's kind of the blueprint of the type of teams that have given the Kings trouble all year. But, you know, for the looking ahead for like what it means in the playoffs, like, I'm actually still somewhat optimistic because they do get up for games against good teams. And so in the playoffs, you're playing good teams. So, you know, right, the hope would be that you're engaged and executing and playing to full potential. But, you know, we still have pretty realistic expectations. It's like, it'd be cool to make the second round this year, but the way it's gone, like, who knows, you know?
Right. But that's important too. Yeah. I was talking to somebody about this. I guess it was before the trade deadline, from a Knicks perspective. You know, mm-hmm. I am from New York. I'm a Knicks fan, you know, by damage. And the question was like, you know, if they don't make this big swing move, or if they don't add like an all-star talent, will you feel like it's like a waste? And I was kind of like, there's a moment where you're saying, I do think that the best version of that team can close the gap on some of the best teams. But also, I have to remember that almost the entirety of my adult life was spent watching really bad basketball, and like that any incremental movement toward positivity or just keeping last year's positivity is still so far removed from what you like the slog you've been through for most of your, you know, professional career or semi-professional career, whatever this is that I do. You saw the lack of professionalism right before we got on the air, as I didn't have my microphone plugged in. Cool podcasting, divine. But that having those realistic expectations, it's still, I mean, when you get there, you still want to be able to kind of have the feeling that there is an upside to be reached for. And I think you mentioned, I think it's like 18-9 is the total record against all the other Western playoff play-in teams, mm-hmm. except if you remove the Pelicans, just slide those guys over to the side and say, enjoy the 4-5 bracket, guys. You guys, you know, whichever side of that, hang out over there and we'll catch you later. I wonder if, based on the general, you know, lack of conversation, level of conversation around the Kings, we are perhaps underselling the optimistic case, you know? Maybe we'll get back to that for a second. The next question I have written for you here is, what do you find most frustrating about the way the Kings are discussed nationally, and why is it Domantas Sabonis? I assumed that, but I might be wrong. But I want to provide the opportunity for you to perhaps clear out, give you an ISO here. Talk to me about Domantas Sabonis and the way that we talk about Domantas Sabonis.
Yeah, so... I love the framing of the question because it's 100% correct. The way that Sabonis gets discussed is insane to me. Sabonis last night racked up his 50th consecutive double-double, which has been done by 8 players in NBA history. I mean, he's nowhere near Chamberlain's record. Chamberlain's record is like 220 something.
I was gonna say, it's over 200 games.
Right? It's insane and
preposterous.
And Chamberlain has the second and third records as well, and they're both over 100. Like it's nuts. But in like the post merger era, it's the second longest streak, second only to Kevin Love's 53. He's got the most triple doubles in the league this year. He is leading the league in rebounding, 5th in assist. Since January 1st, he's first in rebounding and assists across the league, like for totals. And I'm not sure if per game, but for total assists. And he's just he is the engine that drives the Kings. Like, you know, you can talk about, is he the best player? Is Fox the best player? You know, Fox is the crunch time guy, the superstar. But I mean, the Kings don't work without Sabonis, regardless of what the on-off numbers say or anything like that. Like, you watch this Kings team night in, night out. Sabonis is the guy. Like, he is the guy that makes it all work. He may not always put up the gaudiest of scoring numbers, but he does everything. And he's improved his game in all the ways that people said he needed to over the offseason. Like, he doesn't take a lot of threes, but he can reliably hit a three if you leave him wide open up top. He is no longer afraid of taking the free throw line jumper, you know, that was the big talking point in the Warriors series, which people tend to forget he was playing with a broken thumb. And they forget it because he played most of last season with a broken thumb.
That's right.
You know, like, I think my biggest frustration is that the Warriors last year in the playoffs, you know, which, by the way, went 7 games and took Curry going nuclear in the 7th game to, like, put away the Kings. Like, Sabonis is still fighting that perception. And it was just such an awful matchup for him, because not only did they have Looney, who was a big physical rebounder, you know, a great rebounder in his own right. It's not like some scrub came in and out rebounded Sabonis. Like, that's what Looney does. And then, you know, Draymond. So, like, he was always getting one of those two defensively, and they're going to pester you and be physical and disrupt you in different ways. And, you know, the bigger issue with the Kings in that series was shooters all went cold. I mean, Herter, yep. Keegan, I mean, Barnes, no one could hit a shot, and then Fox broke a finger too. Like, I mean,
on his shooting hand, in the middle of the series.
It was all these things that it took for that series to like not go their way. But it all gets boiled down to, well, Sabonis had a bad series. And I mean, I heard a, you know, talking points on national media about, you know, well, I'm not sure he's all NBA because, you know, I can't get that playoff series out of my head. It's like, it drives me crazy that it's like we're holding him responsible for something last season when we're talking about what he's doing this season.
And what he's doing this season, as you mentioned, is nothing short of like historic production. Mm-hmm. And the way you framed his importance to the offense and the role in the offense makes me think of, I know Mike Brown has talked about the identity he wants the team to play to being like fast, physical together. And like what I flash on there, when I thought about the Kings fast, I used to think like Fox end to end, right? Mm-hmm. When I think about the Kings now, I think about how the offense moves side to side with those handoffs, with everybody sprinting around him and orbiting Sabonis, and Sabonis being the guy who makes the side to side decisions about like, no, not you, you come over. Now we do this, and like everything moving, bang, bang, boom. And the physical, of course, is like anybody unfortunate enough to be trailing a wing around those screens. And like that dude, it's like feels like, you know, like Batman would have like the spikes coming off of mm-hmm. his like forearms. That's what all the like every shoulder, every forearm, all those things. I'm like, how is he not just like dislodging guys' jaws doing that, like knocking your neck loose with some of those screens? Like that's what the identity has evolved as it has because of you get him. And then I think there's also the forever like uphill perception battle of we watched Tyrese Haliburton turn into like all NBA, the kind of guard and the kind of playmaker that is easy for everyone to understand and get behind. Mm-hmm. We perhaps undersold and have not paid as much attention collectively to the fact that De'Aaron Fox also became an all NBA guard after that trade. And they also got an all NBA center in that trade. Like, I think we can fairly leave to set aside like who won or whatever, like it led two teams in positive directions. And Sabonis, like, even though he's not as aesthetically pleasing in terms of his game as, you know, Haliburton was or whatever, the necessary evolution of that roster and of that identity, all of it comes from him. Like if he doesn't show up midway through two seasons ago, like the Kings are just in who the hell knows where the Kings are right now in terms of a team that had been sort of desperate for a organizing principle and a definite direction to go in finds it through him. And so now you go from seventh in MVP voting to not on the All-Star team to historic levels of double doubles and triple doubles and the burden of proof still being on him. I think that's, it's a weird place to be.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned seventh in NBA All-Star or MVP voting last year and an All-Star, All-NBA. This year, he's like a point better, a rebound better, and an assist better than his averages last year. Like he's having a better season across the board in every way. And it feels like, you know, people are like, but Sacramento, you know? Which I get it. Like there's that ingrained thought process of like, you know, for nearly two decades, Sacramento was an afterthought and not something you needed to pay attention to. And it takes time to change those perceptions, right? So, you know, I'm realistic about that as well. I also know that we'll never be LA or New York, but it's definitely frustrating sometimes just hearing the way that it gets discussed.
There's also the component of you know, when a commentator doesn't necessarily know, and I'm not using that as like general term to hit at any one person, myself included. If you're like, I don't know exactly what to say about this or what new to say about this, I should maybe either ignore it for now or pick something new to focus on. And the new thing everybody focused on 5 months ago was Keegan Murray, and he's going to make the leap. And oh man, look at the summer league, and he blew up. And you know, like the California Classic, he's looking crazy. And then like the one appearance there, he's looking great. And I think his season, like there was a real nice, you know, early sort of rising action, cresting with that 47 point explosion against the Jazz. And then it's been a little bit tougher with his shot for the last 15, 20 mm-hmm. games. What have you seen from him in this season, and sort of what as the Kings are trying to sort of solidify their position these last 15 games or so, what kind of role does he play in that process?
Well, I think the biggest thing that, because the scoring started off looking like, okay, he's made the leap. It's really exciting because we all get excited about scoring. And it has fallen off. And some of that has been because of the way that the Kings are having him operate in the offense. You know, his rookie year, he basically stood in the corner and was an outlet and a really effective one. You know, could just stand there and make his corner threes. This year, he's creating a lot more off the dribble. He's attacking the basket. He's finding different ways to score at all three levels. And the efficiency has taken a little bit of a step back because of that, but it's really important for his long-term development of what he needs to become for the Kings. So I feel very good about his future as an offensive player. But the biggest leap for him this season has been on defense. He has become such an incredible defender. I mean, blowing away any expectations of what we hoped he might become. I mean, he is a really, really great defender who can guard big, small, perimeter, like, he's blocking shots. He is everywhere. And it's really fun to see that development because that, you know, again, kind of thinking about this year being the year after the year, but for Keegan, it's probably like the year before the year, you know, that year right. three leap and, you know, where he maybe starts to put all of this together. And I'm really excited for his future just based on the fact that now he's not just a guy who can hit some threes, but now he's a guy who can score at all three levels and is a really great defender.
There's a moment every time I'm watching one of those, that sort of development, right? And so with Keegan Murray, especially, I have some notes about his defense in the story that goes up today, but where I am sort of overwhelmed by how obvious something is that I didn't, and then my idiocy in not seeing it, where I'm like, well, that certainly does appear to be a 6'8" guy with long arms and quick feet who's really strong. I guess I wonder if he'll ever become a defender. It's like, it's the thing. It's it is the whole thing. Everybody's looking for that guy, that mm-hmm. size, that shape, those skills. And yeah, like if he's smart enough to do this, moving into the right places on offense, maybe the other thing comes too. But then like seeing it come to fruition to where like Mike Brown is not just going to like put somebody on an assignment just to do it. Like he's enough of a defensive minded kind of crusty old coach in that way where you need to earn the trust. And but he's also open enough to a young guy earning the trust that he'll give him those responsibilities. So like seeing Keegan Murray guarding like Steph and, you know, Devin Booker and guys like that, you're like, holy cow, that he's earned that trust that quickly is pretty remarkable. And yes, in the construct of the Kings starting lineup and in the roster as it's put together right now, they need him to do those jobs. They might need him to do some of the point of attack jobs a little bit less, though. And here's where I give my second clear out for you. We'll start with an introductory stat that I love. The Kings are 20th in defense for the full season, 20th since the All-Star break, but 7th over the last 3 weeks, a period that coincides with heavier minutes for Keon Ellis. And Greg, I would like for you to tell the good people, spread the good word of Keon Ellis to the people.
Keon Ellis is just awesome. Like he is just, he is so fun. It's one of those things where kind of your point of like, where you suddenly see the obvious thing. It's like, how did no one recognize, you know, within like the Kings staff or whatever, like how did no one like recognize the opportunity to like put him in? Because, you know, we talked for most of the season, like, man, if the Kings just had like one more guy who could defend the perimeter, and Keon Ellis can defend the perimeter. I mean, you know, one bad look off of Jalen Brunson aside, I mean, he had an amazing defensive game against him. So Ellis is like 6'4"-ish, but has like a 6'8 wingspan and is just a smart defender, pesky defender. He's not a complete zero on offense. He had 5 blocks last night against the Grizzlies. I mean,
yeah,
he is just everywhere.
The number to know here, and it's because, and I had to, I checked it and was like, again, I'm not very smart, so I have to make sure I do the addition right. During this sort of stretch, since the All-Star break, as his minutes have ticked up, blocks per 36, stats per 36, deflections per 36, add them up, 9.3 per 36 minutes. You add those things together. So it's just like every couple of minutes or every minute and a half, he's just blowing up a possession. Mm-hmm. Like he is ending it and getting it going the other way or forcing you late into the clock. And that stuff doesn't even capture your, you know, he just has the right understanding of the switch to go like, I'm going to, or you're trying to navigate and communicate through a stack pick and roll. And he's like, nope, he will be tight on the body of the guy, then let go and make space for his teammates to come through. Like, understanding how to move, even though he's barely played a lot of minutes with a lot of the starters or, you know, the guys that are heavy into the rotation. The fact that the Kings go from like, slightly below average defense to, and again, small sample size caveats, mm-hmm. whatever, mm-hmm. but like the eye test matches the numbers where you're like, that guy is disruptive as hell. He makes sense in what they're asking him to do on all different kinds of sort of number one options or, you know, lead ball handlers, point of attack guys. You can switch with him. You can have him go over the top of screens. There's just, you can press up with him, all these sorts of things. If they go from like, because the recipe last year was best offense in the NBA allows you to be like the 20th defense. Mm-hmm. If you're not the number one offense in the NBA, you need to be better on defense. And if they're suddenly closer to like top 10, top 12 and top 10, top 12, then you're a very different team. Whether that's good enough to win multiple rounds, I don't know. But it in moving toward the kind of identity that Mike Brown has talked about wanting and feeling like we need to be more, you know, physical and more active on defense, this is a really neat pathway to doing that.
Yeah, the other exciting thing is that the Kings have not been very good at finding those little hidden gems, right? Like, you know, there haven't been many of those over the years. Like, they have not had a great track record the last, you know, 5-6 years for second round picks or undrafted guys. And you know, Keon Ellis was an undrafted guy, two-way contract, and then, you know, earned himself a full contract finally this year. So I think the great teams all have those guys.
Yeah.
You know, because you need that, you know, just the value of the salary cap, but also just the unexpected talent injection. And it definitely raises the ceiling. You know, again, how much it raises it this year, I don't know. But long term, very exciting because, like you said, Keon Ellis is still really young, still doesn't have that much NBA experience. And he's already shown such great awareness and, you know, very excited for how he changes the dimensions for the Kings.
I can even forgive the Brunson thing because he's like he's trying to do his work early and see where the screen's coming from so that he can force him away from his strong left hand. Like these are sins of commission in a like a positive sense on the defensive end. Like, and then you go make up for it with friggin' 4 steals or 5 blocks. Like this is everything. It's all like positive stuff being added to the table, and it's like reaching into your pocket and finding 100. Like that's kind of where it feels like right now. And for a team where I mentioned like the defensive improvement is important. And I know that Mike Brown has talked about finding that defensive identity. De'Aaron Fox recently had said something to the effect of like our season will be determined by, you know, where we are defensively. The reason for that to some degree is that the offense hasn't been quite what it was last season. And I mentioned earlier, some of that is just like the league has risen around it. Right. Mm-hmm. But some of it is. Your share of shots at the rim is down. Your free throw rate is down. Fox is like, there are moments where he's a little more in love with the three than he isn't getting to the rim. Drives are down. Like, still a lot of, you know, a high volume driver, but like not quite where it has been. What have you made of what the offense looks like this year? And do you have any concerns about that as you sort of head down the stretch and into the postseason?
Yeah. The biggest concern I've seen is that there's times when they seem to kind of abandon the system. This year, like last year, it was just almost every time you saw the dribble handoffs and the flow and you knew how the Kings offense was going to move. And they still do a good amount of that. But there's also times when it feels like they don't know what to do against a defense and they'll just kind of swing it around the perimeter, but no one's really moving. No one's really doing anything. Or they'll get ISO heavy, especially late in games, and it drives me crazy. It's like, that's not your good offense. Like, I mean, as good as Fox is, like, to clear out ISO for Fox or Monk, like, it's not always going to work. I mean, sometimes it does. Like, you know, if either one of them is having a great night, like Monk was last night against the Grizzlies, it can work. But it's just not, it's not a system to create opportunities. It's just go make something happen.
And it does, it minimizes the the impact that the other guys can have, right? Mm-hmm. Like Sabonis becomes a less valuable offensive player when you're just kind of like going 1-4 flat and moving him off, or, you know, you're less likely to generate the highest value shots if the goal is to generate a mismatch for a step back midi. Like you're reducing your margin for error, and maybe like as good as Fox was last year, you know, won the Clutch Player of the Year award, was, you know, deservingly one of the all NBA guards, a little bit of a dip, you know, if you go from whatever it was, like 53% on those shots to 45% on those shots, like that swings games, right? That swings major possessions late in these tight games. And Monk is an interesting part of that. You mentioned I think he outscored the Grizzlies by himself in overtime last night. And, you know, he's had these explosions, like the 35 points after halftime against the Wolves. And he's, you know, I think if not the leading scorer off the bench, then up there among them, this is like going to be, one of the favorites to be a finalist for Sixth Man of the Year. It does feel a little bit like, even though, you know, like Fox or Sabonis, whether they're the one, two of the best players, it feels a little bit like they go as Monk goes a lot of the time, like in terms of just the attitude and the pulse of the team. I guess, do you have any concerns about that as like, well, he's going to have to be a huge part of the solution as our like undersized sixth man, but he's got to be in the closing lineups and he's got to be the ball in his hands to kind of make the most out of him. Like, as you're looking for what's the iteration of this moving forward, how do you get past the first round? Like, is Monk, do you have confidence in Monk being the a positive answer in that way?
Generally speaking, I do. Like, Monk's attitude and his swagger and everything he brings to the team, like, it's such a huge lift for the Kings.
Oh, yeah, it's infectious. It elevates everybody.
It's so much fun. The one concern I have is that Malik Monk becomes very aware of big moments and tries to hit the home run every time. And there's nights when he's just not there, or it's just like, we didn't need a shot with, you know, 15 seconds left on the shot clock there. You know, he like feeds off the crowd energy, and it's like, oh, if I make this, the crowd's going to go nuts, you know? So there's those moments when he gets a little too amped up by the moment, and that's a little concerning. But generally speaking, I feel positive about it, just because that energy that he brings and that confidence and that swagger, like, he is never afraid of the moment. And that is a huge factor. You know, that's the positive side of that being too excited about things, is that, you know, he's not intimidated by it. He's not going to shy away from it. So, you know, sometimes you need that guy to come out and just take the reckless shot. And then, like, you know, if he makes it, he's going to skip down the court. And if he misses it, he'll probably still skip down the court. And, you know, it's great.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I would say, yeah, the place I land with them is that, like, if you told me kind of whatever the matchup winds up being, that none of the Kings' best three guys are the best guy in a given series, like, I understand that, you know, you're talking about, you know, top of the ballot kind of guys on a lot of these other teams in the West. But if you told me that in individual games in a series, any of the Kings' three best guys could be the best guy on the floor in a game, I could buy that. And so, which makes, puts them in an interesting position where this is now year two of, I think, teams looking in the first round. You know, Jaden McDaniels recently was like, I'm not too worried about the Kings. I think we could beat them four straight if we needed to, this after getting beaten by the Kings. But nevertheless, the Kings sort of profile as that team that maybe they're your friendliest matchup in round one. You know, that was the conversation last year. You know, who's going to want to line up with them this year? They wouldn't be the favorite in that series, or have the home court advantage in that series. But I think still people look at the Kings and say, if you had your druthers, you'd go with them. I'm going to flip that because, as you mentioned, there are the track record of the Kings against good teams has been so positive. So I'm going to ask you, if you're the Kings, who are you looking at in the first round? I mean, I think we've established that the Pelicans are not the ones. You don't want that particular kind of smoke. But if you're the Kings, who are you thinking? You get your pick of them seeding matchups. Who would you like to see?
I mean, if we're looking at the current top four, you know, right now the top four is Thunder, Wolves, Nuggets, Clippers. And if we're assuming the Kings don't launching themselves into the top four, because that feels pretty unrealistic.
It would be an incredible last few weeks.
It'd be pretty crazy. But if we're just picking based on the current top four, I think that the team that they would match up best with is going to be the Thunder. You know, you're looking at another young team, you know, doesn't have, you know, the wealth of playoff experience. You know, Shai has a little bit, but they match up fairly well and have played them well. I don't know that the Kings would win that series, but of the four, it would probably be my pick. You know, I like Sabonis going at Chet just because, you know, the physicality has given Chet some problems this year. That would be my pick, but it's also one of those things where you're like, you're picking amongst four like really great teams. So like any one of those is going to be a really tough matchup, but the Kings have actually played well against all four of those teams. So, you know, I feel like they'd have a decent shot at maybe having an upset, but you also wouldn't be like too surprised if they didn't advance past any of those teams. So, you know, it's kind of a weird thing, but I do think that they would match up best against the Thunder out of the current top four.
There would be a certain poetry to that too, where it's like, 1 year after the Kings were the, you know, darling story of the league, and everyone's like, you know, how wonderful that they've gotten to this place this early to then turn around and just end the Thunder's version of that. We like that. There's the joy that we aspire to, but also this like the viciousness that comes along the other side of it. This is still a game about buckets and competitors. Before we go any further with our buckets or competing, we're going to take a quick break, pay some bills, and we'll be back in just a minute on Divine Intervention. Welcome back to Divine Intervention. We are going to move on now to something that we like to call the closing five because, Greg, as I'm sure you know, how you start, not nearly as important as how you finish. Five questions for our illustrious guest. Question the first. You watch a lot of basketball. You talk about it a lot. You read about it a lot. You write about it a lot. And you listen to things about it a lot. But ball is not life. Greg, what do you do to get away from all of this? What does self-care look like for you?
For me, it's golf. Now, I live in Colorado, so winter is very rough. So we're just still getting over a big spring snowstorm here and waiting for it to all melt. And but then we're expecting golf season to kind of pick up. So that's it for me. You're getting out, you get to be outside, have a couple of beverages, you know, just hang out with some friends, make a fool of myself on the golf course. That's my getaway from it all.
I respect that. I mean, it's a good walk spoiled, right?
Exactly.
Like that's the idea. Like, you know, you're getting your outside time, but you're managing to cut that with just anger, frustration, and the occasional drink. Sounds like a real recipe for some good downtime there to me. Question number two. You've had the benefit of a few years of distance here. When you think about the DeMarcus Cousins era, how do you think about it? Is it more like fondness or frustration?
It's frustration, but not around him so much. You know,
right.
It's easier to look back and kind of see his flaws. Like, you know, I often see Sabonis complaining to the refs as he's running back up the court. And I think, oh, that's very nice compared to Cousins complaining while standing under the basket while the play is happening.
He's
down
at least running. Yeah.
So, you know, there's things I can recognize and be like, yeah, I'm glad we're not dealing with that anymore. But it's definitely more frustration. You know, when I think back, especially to the year they fired Michael Malone, like that will always hurt me because that team really was talented and was on the right track. And I truly believe that the drought could have ended a lot earlier if they had just kept Michael Malone at that point. You know, it's more just, you know, the combination of the Maloofs and then Vivek coming in and kind of new owner mistakes and, you know, kind of all the different things that contributed to kind of ruining that era. Yeah. So it's more frustration, but, you know, those were the lean times that made us appreciate what we're dealing with now. So,
well, first off, I love that reframing. Good job there at the end, making, you know, saying like, this is what allows me to be positive about today. Yeah. The other side of it is I always think about that moment on the bench. You talked about bench shenanigans earlier when Boogie's headband was a little bit messed up and Omri Caspi fixed it for him and then just reached over, pounded it out. Like That's really friendship goals, as far as I'm concerned. That's what I remember most about it. Also, having like an absurd, incredible stat line, and then immediately going to the post game interview and being like, the referees are ridiculous. you know, it's like instantly complaining about that, but understandably so. I am going to turn into the guy that I make fun of on the internet, where it's like, kids don't know Boogie was a problem.
Yeah.
You know, like that guy was a bucket. You know, like I he's the guy I'm going to do that with.
Perfect.
Like, no, you don't know. You don't know. He was a problem.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're listening to this, you probably know it was a problem. And if you don't, do your Googles. Question number three. Earlier this week, you screenshotted a Spotify playlist, something that was generated for you entitled Whiny Stomping Grounds. What artists appeared on this playlist? And is there a place in your life that you would call your Whiny Stomping Grounds?
So the first part I can answer, the Whiny Stomping Grounds. I mean, that's what blogs are, right? I mean, that's what we do. We whine and complain about our sports, and you know, that's what that's for.
Yes.
The music itself, I couldn't tell you many of the artists on there. A couple of them ended up getting added to some other playlists, but it was mostly stuff I hadn't heard of, but it was like all like Midwest emo stuff.
All right.
You know, which I find both nostalgic and easy to tune out. So it's great background while, you know, working, writing, whatever you might be doing. Like, so that's what that was generated based off of.
Whiny Stomping Grounds. That's perfect. Yeah. I mean, Midwest emo Whiny Stomping Grounds. That is it. You know, whatever our qualms with Spotify, and there are many, that you nailed that one. All right, question number four. You get to pick one king from the past to put on this year's team for the stretch run. Who is it and why?
Oh, so we always debate this, and there's a couple of candidates. I think if I'm going for one person to add to the current roster, though, I'd go with Mitch Richmond.
Okay. Talk me through it. Talk me what's the thought process?
So big, strong score. You know, he can, you know, post up guys, he can shoot from outside, he, you know, gives you scoring at every level, and also historically underrated defender. I mean, just a phenomenal defender, you know, gives you more toughness on the outside and defensively, which, you know, we kind of talked about elevating that defense would be big for the Kings. So I'd probably go with him. But you could also very quickly make a case for Chris Webber being a pretty amazing complement to Sabonis and Fox. Like, that'd be pretty great too. So it's probably a coin flip. I don't think you could go wrong either way, though.
I'm so sorry. The answer is always Jason Williams.
That's going.
You know, I mean, some a lot of these don't have right answers, but some of them do. And
that's
it's
a good point.
You know, there's no way around that. Question number five. I've always felt a certain kinship with you because you like to use Twitter for jokes, discovering and sharing little jokes, which I thought was the whole point.
Yeah.
And then the world got mad. I realize I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but this show is nothing if not a venue for the promotion of little bits of joy. Do you have a favorite little joke writer or a little joke account or several favorites? You retweet a lot of them. So it's like, I'm wondering where this all comes from. Like, I want to use this as a place for, here are some things that you might make your day 1% happier. And Greg, you seem to have a lot of those.
Yeah, and that's actually where it started, with doing the retweeting a bunch of just random weird jokes. Is it was just, I would actually do that when I was in a bad mood or upset at the world or whatever.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I would just be like, I need to get in a better headspace, so I'm going to go over. And what I do is I actually have just a list. It's a private list. I just call it Weird Twitter, but it's just a bunch of joke accounts. And then those joke accounts are retweeting other people, so they show up in the list and it just builds. So I don't have one off the top of my head because there's a bunch of them. I'm thinking of a good like gateway drug. There's one, Fred Delicious is one. That's one I can think of just off the top of my head, and then kind of build out from there. But yeah,
that's it. Listen, one is a great starting point. That's all we're asking for.
There you go.
Also, I have to imagine that's the first time on the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast feed that the phrase Fred Delicious has been uttered.
Hopefully not the last.
I mean, I would imagine. Listen, you know, your lips to God's ears. We'll have to see. But that's also, I won't harp on it, but I love that as like, I'm upset or I'm cranky about something. Let me actively seek out jokes. Like, what a good way to self-regulate. What a great, like, I could bring this into the world and just be like kind of cranky and upset, or I could make myself laugh and try to level out. Listen, guys, Greg was sitting out here giving you jewels. Like, this is the way to move in the world. Please do it. We go from that weekly recommendation. If you just want to stand on Fred Delicious, you certainly are allowed to. But we do a weekly recommendation here. That's how we get out of the Divine Intervention. Does not have to be about basketball. Can be about anything in the world. Past examples have included, you know, various books and TV shows and movies, listening to the Andre 3000 flute record while you do stuff, cooking dinner for somebody to show them that you care about them. All kinds of different recommendations here. Is something that you think is cool and good you would like to share with the people. Greg Wissinger, do you have such a recommendation?
I do. It's something that I, you know, had been aware of years ago and kind of got back into in a deeper depth this just within the last month or two. And that is the album Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits.
Hell yeah.
So I grew up, like, my dad was a big Dire Straits fan, but I pretty much knew, like, you know, Walk of Life and Sultan's a Swing and Money for Nothing. But then, like, one day I just, like, randomly, you know, threw on that album while I was working, and just start to finish, it's such a fantastic album, amazing sound mixing, like, and just there were several songs in there I'm like, oh, I didn't even remember that this was them or this was on this album. And
right,
I mean, so cannot recommend it enough. You know, it's an album that would not see the light of day today. Like, every song is like 8 minutes long, but it's fantastic. And, you know, it's very mellow. It's very calming. It's perfect background music for whatever you're doing.
I love that. That's fantastic. I don't know that mine, I feel like it's a little bit of a similarity in terms of, like, the tone of it being sort of maybe a little more mellow. It's the movie Warrior, 2011 movie Warrior, which is both an aggressive mixed martial arts movie and a sort of like haunting family drama about, you know, splintered brotherhood and dealing with the alcoholic father. There's a lot going on in Warrior. The MMA part is real. I mean, Tom Hardy looks jacked. Like, he looks like Venom, like the CGI Venom, but, like, it's just Tom Hardy's actual neck. Joel Edgerton is great, and to the point where my kids have been watching nothing but Star Wars for a very long time, and when Joel Edgerton shows up in the Star Wars prequels, I'm like, oh, there's the dude from Warrior. And they're like, no, that's like Uncle Owen. I'm like, I don't care. It's the guy from Warrior. It is, Nick Nolte is incredible. It's aggressive MMA movie that is, like, soundtracked by multiple songs from The National. The vibes are weird and a little bit I'm not doing a great job recommending it, but I am recommending it. Directed by Gavin O'Connor, who also directed Miracle, Miracle on Ice movie. He directed The Accountant, the Ben Affleck is an accountant who is also an assassin movie. And The Way Back, Ben Affleck as a basketball coach. So the director has a interesting way of looking at big male feelings. And this is a lot of big male feelings in this. Super producer John Gennaro notes that it somehow perfectly captures the sadness of Atlantic City. I think that's fair. There's a big MMA tournament that happens in Atlantic City, and it's not the same kind of, like, glitzy big fight feel that you'd find in Vegas. Kurt Angle is in it, basically being TNA era Kurt Angle, but as a guy named Koba. He just has one name, Koba. But he looks absolutely terrifying. And so this is a lot to recommend here. 2 hours and 20 minutes of big male feelings in every direction. I recommend it to you. I also recommend to the listeners, if you're looking, I don't know if it's 2 hours of male feelings in every direction, but the King's Herald podcast. If you want to hear more talk about the Sacramento Kings, if you want to hear Greg and the wonderful staff of the King's Herald discussing this interesting basketball team at a very interesting time in its life, you should go there. You should support the King's Herald. You should check out all things there. Greg, anything else we can point people toward on the way out the door, where they can catch your work, etc.?
Yeah, I would just actually point out that we actually have two podcasts, one feed. So there's the King's Herald show. That is with Jerry Reynolds, former color commentator.
Jerry Reynolds, the great Jerry Reynolds. Yeah.
He is fantastic. He's an absolute gem. So every other week, it's him and two of our guys. And then we also have Living the Beam podcast on the same feed. And that's me and two of the others from the site. So just kind of more of a casual conversation. That one's more of like the after hours drinks are heavily encouraged type of podcast. but definitely two very different podcasts on one feed for you.
And if you want to get a better sense of the weird Twitter sharings of Greg Wissinger, you can find him at GWISS, GWISS on Twitter. I heartily recommend it. That's going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. I want to thank Greg Wissinger for taking all this time to be with us and to reconnect with himself. Thank you so much to super producer John Gennaro for doing all of the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. Vinny Goodwill will be back tomorrow on this feed with another episode of The Good Word with Goodwill. And I will be back with Jake Fisher for No Cap Room on Thursday. And we'll be back next week with another Divine Intervention. I think that's about it. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.